language, hearing people that are government leaders say bad things about them. So I think the media does play a role here, and there's a way to do it very respectfully and ensure protections for trans kids without compromising the media goals and respecting the facts.
Absolutely. We've been speaking with Christy Mallory. She's legal director at the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law. Thank you so much, Christy Mallory, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Yes, of course. Thank you so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Do you miss going to the theater? Looking for some drama? Then tune in for The Strange Case of Nick M., an all-new radio play by Imago Theater on Monday, May 3rd at 10 p.m. Listeners will be taken on Imago's trippy audio journey into a fragmentary world, narrated by a cocky podcaster who has unearthed a box of long-forgotten reel-to-reel tapes. So tune in on Monday, May 3rd at 10 p.m. and get ready for a very special premiere of Imago's The Strange Case of Nick M. right here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned natural foods cooperative featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and farmers market every Wednesday year-round. Located at Southeast Tibbetts Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroot News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all of the things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
welcome to another edition of Let's Talk About Race. This is part two of another racial reckoning in America. Now, please be advised, there will always be another mass shooting, there will always be another political story, and there'll always be another news cycle. These should not distract us from recognizing another racial reckoning in the AAPI community. In case you missed highlights from part one, here's our guest, Mary Lee, from Multnomah County in Portland, Oregon.
I think the answer very simply to the question of is there anti-Asian violence is yes. Is COVID the reason for this increase in violence, or what is? And I want to say that this anti-Asian violence and the link to COVID-19 is simply an excuse. COVID is an excuse. There is a completely long legacy in this country of xenophobia and anti-Asian violence that started in the 1800s for railroad workers and the Chinese Exclusion Act. One of the very first times where a body of people, a country, and unfortunately we've seen this now happen to others, were excluded on the basis of their country of origin. To World War II, when Japanese Americans were interned in concentration camps, through to the murder of Vincent Chin and the death, I think, of the automobile industry, at least as it was, to today and the ways in which many U.S. leaders have been speaking about the coronavirus. And the through line of this history encompasses a hypersexualization and subservience, a picture of AAPI women, and these pairing of the yellow peril and the model minority stereotypes and dog whistles. It is all encompassed in this conversation of anti-Asian violence. And for those who are shocked or surprised, I would just invite you to take a look at history and take a look at the history of anti-Asian violence, specifically as it relates to Asian peoples here in this country.
As we continue our discussion, part two of Stopping AAPI Hate, we are going to discuss the invisibility of the Asian American community until they're not, the myth of the model minority, and the diversity within Asian American communities. In addition, we are also going to advocate and model bystander intervention. We cannot continue to allow our Asian American community members to be victimized twice, by violence on the street, verbal and physical, and by bystanders who do not intervene. We must intervene and stand up for our Asian American community members. That's on this edition of Let's Talk About Race. So our guest talked about how Asian Americans are invisible in America. It's a class issue. So you have the model minority, and then you have the struggling immigrant. My question to the panel, are Asian Americans invisible in our society? Let's start with Professor Johnson.
Yes, I think there is an invisibility. That notion of being the model minority, that stereotype, I think, is something Asians are really rejecting. They don't want to be stereotyped in that way, but they have been within this culture viewed as the model minority, that framework. And to say that they're a model minority actually pits them against other minorities, because if you're the model minority, then there must be minorities who are not. And I do think the struggling immigrant and the problems with Asians, if we just think about our focus in this country on poverty, we never talk about the fact in the Asian community, they are struggling economically. We very rarely hear their issues being brought forward within the media or in broader focus by the public. I think also that notion of being the model minority and excelling in math and engineering, you find there are a lot of Asians in IT, but there are very few leaders that are Asian in the tech community. Those are just some examples that come to mind for me.
Althea.
The invisibility aspect is definitely amplified by the limited frames through which Asian Americans are typically seen in popular culture. That's like even extra compounded by the fact that Asians, Asian Americans, and Pacific Islanders are not a monolithic community, not even in the slightest. They represent people from a huge swath of the land on this planet, with a variety of different cultures, practices, beliefs, heritage. Even more so is not, you know, explored in an individual way or given due space.
There's a really good King of the Hill episode where the neighbors, you know, from Laos, he's Laotian. Hank Hill's like, so are you Chinese or are you Japanese, right? And then the guy's like, no, I'm from Laos. Like, you know, it's a Southeast Asian country. And then in the end, he's like, okay. He's like, so are you Chinese or are you Japanese, right?
Every time I meet somebody new, the question always comes up, where are you from? And I always want to say Minnesota, but you know what they mean.
I was at a bar and someone asked me my name and I said Rachel. And then they said, okay, but like, what's your real name?
Chinese are not the same as Japanese, are not the same as Koreans, are not the same as Filipinos or Thai or, you know, Indians.
And not every single Asian person gets into college. Not every single Asian person goes to a great school. Not every single person has, you know, a great job.
I can still be Japanese American and know that part of myself and know that history. But it's also okay to still identify as a gangly little suburban kid. And I'm fine with that.
I remember seeing like Wayne's World growing up and I was like, oh, Tia Carrere, she's Filipino, Hawaiian Filipino. And they're like, no, she's playing Cantonese. And I was like, oh, we don't even get to be ourselves. We don't even get to be who we are. We have to play at something else.
Most times in high school or places like this, you don't really have an outlet where you can talk about these Asian American issues. Even in the workplace, you know, you need Asian American mentors who experience the bamboo ceiling, something that happens in corporate America. So most times if you actually look at it, you'll see that a lot of Asian Americans, for instance, you know, they're in middle management or they're in engineering, but you don't really see them in high CEO roles. And the reason being is oftentimes our culture, for instance, you know, my mom always tells me, don't ask for a raise, keep your head down. You know, when you do your work, your boss will basically, you know, see that you're doing well and he'll give you a raise. But in America, it's not like that. America's the squeakiest wheel gets the oil, right?
People sometimes say that, Nobuko, just forget about Japanese-ness. Just open up yourself more and be more expressive and be more upfront and straightforward.
That goes back to the stereotype of like, oh, like, no one talks about Asians because Asians don't speak up.
My parents didn't want me to learn the language. They thought that if I were to learn Tagalog at home, that I would have an accent and I would have the struggles that they had because they were shamed for having thick accents when they first immigrated to the US. I think I struggle with it even now, that talking to my parents, I think they do regret those moments of wanting something different for me.
I have two younger sisters who are 10 and 8, and I really feel it's my responsibility to help them come to terms with the identity crisis I know they're going through and bridging the gap between the American culture that they deal with at school and the Asian culture they deal with at home.
There is just so much beauty in the distinction and different cultures out there that I think it would be to everyone's advantage to learn more about all the different places we come from.
I love seeing that these communities are asking for representation because it's so important to me. And I think my ownership is getting to be a part of that.
And even celebrate the fact that it's so cool to be different, to have something to offer that someone else may not, and to exchange ideas rather than just try to be the same idea. I think that concept is just, it frees you so much. There's so much freedom in that.
There is also this entire legacy other minority communities experience. Asian Americans also experience racial redlining that continue to push out and marginalize physically minority communities in the United States. So having limited frames and seeing their perspectives or struggles or interests as a monolithic idea, I think, is a real challenge, and visibility certainly is one way to help.
Now, Thea, we planned this show prior to the tragedy that happened in Atlanta. Why did you want us to start this discussion? Or why did you want us to talk about
violence against Asian Americans?
It was partially because of this invisibility aspect. It was a growing trend, really heartbreakingly growing, and the statistics are really upsetting, but that it wasn't, I mean, prior to this Atlanta massacre, we weren't seeing a whole lot of news coverage of it or having the conversation of what is there to be done and where is it in my community that either I can offer support or I can put eyes on situations in which people are being harmed. It wasn't something that it felt something that we would address within the framework of this show, but that the visibility of the issue was, when we were planning it, at the very least, not quite at the forefront.
Cecil, talk show host.
I think the idea or the phrase model minority reveals more about the dominant culture than it does about the multiple identities and cultures of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. It is a continuation that there is a dominant culture that all people should become like. And the closer they are like, the better they are. So we have this attempt to label Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders as model minority because it's a way in which we can cover our eyes to the multiple cultural, linguistic differences among that large group of peoples, and the attempt to narrow what we think a so-called good American should be and act like. And so the attempt to narrowly talk about a groups of people is reveals more about how lazy the dominant culture is. So it doesn't only happen with Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. It happens with those who we label as Latino or Latinx people. People from Mexico are as different from people from the Dominican Republic, as different as people from Central America, as different as from people in the southern part of South America. We make the same error or laziness when we talk about indigenous people, ignoring the vast cultural differences in languages and practices among people who are indigenous to this land. And it also extends to those we label African American, ignoring the diversity of cultures and practices within those who are descendants of African, those who were descendants of those who were enslaved from Africa, the multiple cultures within the United States, and not even beginning to talk about the multiple culture of descendants of Africans in the Caribbean, Africa, Europe, and all over the world. It's past time for people to stand up and say, we will not be defined by who you say we are. Here we are, hear our voice, see us.
You probably know this stereotype. Asians are hardworking, super smart, and really good at math and science. And all those things seem good, right?
It's so reductive because, you know, it's really stripping away the fact that you as an individual are talented or smart and saying, oh, it's because of your race.
This idea of the intelligent, well-behaved Asian American is known as the model minority myth. But don't be fooled by the name. It's not a compliment. It's one of the most persistent Asian American stereotypes and comes with some really harmful consequences. To fully understand it, we have to look at its origins and how we went from this to this. Hey, I'm Anna, and this Sunday on AJ Plus, we're dissecting the model minority myth, showing its evolution and highlighting how harmful it is, not only for Asians, but for all communities of color. Belinda tried to fit the mold for years.
I would say the model minority myth affected my relationship with myself and kind of clouding my vision of who I was as a person.
And Belinda's not alone in experiencing this. To learn more about the model minority myth, we spoke to Frank Wu, a professor in Asian American Studies.
The model minority myth is dangerous because it's a racial stereotype. It's a story, a script, that even though a little part of it is true, once we accept this racial generalization, it goes all sorts of places that we can't control.
You know, this model minority concept didn't always exist. When Chinese immigrants first showed up in the U.S. in the 1800s, white America saw them as heathens who stole their jobs and raped their women. This was known then as the Yellow Peril. The xenophobia and discrimination escalated, leading Congress to pass the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, which completely banned Chinese immigration to the U.S. Sounds kind of familiar, huh?
The notion that if you're Asian, you can never become American. You can't be a full member of this society.
And it didn't end there. As Asian immigration grew throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, they continued to face discrimination. There were violent mobs during the 1930s against Filipinos in Northern California, and of course, there was the Japanese internment during World War II. This scapegoating of various Asian communities went on until about the 1960s. And then in 1966, the New York Times published a piece by Professor William Peterson titled Success Story, Japanese American Style. This article is considered one of the most influential stories ever written on Asian Americans and effectively gave birth to the term model minority. It said, barely more than 20 years after the end of the wartime camps, this is a minority that has risen above even prejudiced criticism. By any criterion of good citizenship, the Japanese Americans are better than any other group in our society, including native-born whites. At first, the term only applied to Japanese Americans. Then it quickly grew to include all East Asians. Then eventually, anyone who even looks slightly Asian.
What is said of Chinese is extended to Japanese, what's said of Japanese is transferred to Koreans, and so on and so on and so on. That's why the model minority myth has just expanded, because people really can't tell the difference. They can't be bothered.
And the success was partially true, at least in the realm of education. By the mid-1900s, Asian Americans, on average, had higher levels of education than African Americans. But that wasn't the whole story. In 1965, the Immigration Act reversed years of restrictive immigration policies that virtually banned all immigration from Asia. But it allowed only those with certain backgrounds to enter the U.S., namely professionals like doctors and engineers. It was a brain drain. And right as the civil rights movement was gaining steam, the model minority stereotype started to gain traction.
From the very beginning, the model minority myth has been false flattery. It's not even really about people of Asian descent. It's a way to insult African Americans, Hispanics, and others.
But despite this stereotype of Asians as submissive and keeping their heads down, Asians have a long and storied history of civil disobedience in this country, which is often overlooked by the media. The media also plays a role in perpetuating stereotypes about Asians. In 2014, former Fox News host Bill O'Reilly sparked a controversy when he asked,
"Do we have Asian privilege in America? Because the truth is that Asian American households earn far more money than anyone else."
He cited Asian academics and median household incomes as being better than those of whites. Probably unsurprising coming from a man who doesn't believe in white privilege. And a conservative political commentator, Andrew Sullivan, ignited a debate around the model minority myth when he wrote, quote, "Asian Americans, like Jews, are indeed a problem for the social justice brigade. How have bigoted white people allowed these minorities to do so well, even to the point of earning more, on average, than whites?"
The model minority myth has always been used as propaganda, as a way to say, yes, we applaud the Asians, but really what we're doing is denigrating other racial minorities by saying, if Asians can do this, it means there's no racial discrimination, disparities don't count.
Sullivan's piece was seen as a thinly veiled attack on African Americans, while not mentioning them at all, or the systemic injustices they've consistently faced, even after the Civil Rights era. But here's the problem. The truth is lost in the numbers. For example, if you compare the net worth of Chinese or Japanese Americans to Korean Americans, you see a stark difference. Meanwhile, 1/5 of Vietnamese Americans don't have a high school diploma and often end up in low-paying service jobs. And almost 40% of the Hmong community have less than a high school degree, about 25 percentage points lower than both the Asian American and U.S. averages. Asian American leaders have lobbied for a breakdown of the government statistics so that each of these communities' educational, housing, and language needs can be met. But there's another issue around Asians that few are talking about, the undocumented. One out of every 7 Asian immigrants is undocumented. That's 1.7 million people. That's about the size of Dallas, Texas. Many undocumented Asian immigrants would qualify for DACA, or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program introduced under President Obama. So why aren't more undocumented Asians coming forward?
They're kind of reluctant to seek help. They internalize the struggles they go through because they're expected to put on this outward appearance of being stable and being successful.
The stereotype of the model minority becomes internalized for many Asians in the U.S., and there are some pretty devastating consequences.
As a child, I remember having obsessive compulsive disorder and kind of using different like rituals, compulsions, and symptoms of that to kind of feel a sense of control in my own life, in a world where I felt like I lacked control.
Asian Americans are also less likely to seek help for their emotional or mental health problems than white Americans. And US-born Asian women, even more so. They have a higher lifetime rate of suicidal thoughts than the general US population. That's almost 16% of Asian American women, as compared to 13.5% of the general population. The suicide death rates are 30% higher for Asian American girls and women between 15 and 24 than they are for their white peers.
Looking back, I didn't really realize that throughout my junior high and high school years, I was pretty severely depressed. I've been medicated since, and I think that there should be absolutely no shame or stigma involved with mental health.
And despite the fact that some Asian groups have higher levels of wealth and education and are represented in higher numbers than other minority groups in fields like tech and medicine, it doesn't mean that things are necessarily better. Asian Americans are still heavily underrepresented in business, media, sports, and government, a phenomenon described as the bamboo ceiling. For example, only 3% of the total board seats in Fortune 500 companies in the U.S. are Asian or Pacific Islander, and top-level positions in business are still overwhelmingly filled by white people. And for all that higher education, Asians realize lower returns than white people. This means Asians need more years of schooling to earn the same amount of money as their white counterparts. And perhaps the most glaringly underrepresented field is one we all look at every single day: media. Can you remember the last time an Asian actor played a romantic lead in a major motion picture? Or a lead at all, for that matter? Asian actors regularly struggle to get starring roles in movies or TV shows, even when the characters that are being cast are Asian.
The fear of Asians has always been takeover, invasion, that Asians will overwhelm California and the West Coast. So one way to deal with that in the images that we see on the television and at movies is to take situations where you would have Asian American characters and to make them white.
So not only is Hollywood not casting Asians in big movies or TV shows, but they're erasing Asian narratives and perspectives. Think Ghost in the Shell and ScarJo, or Emma Stone in Aloha, where white actresses played characters originally written as Asian. Shout out to Ed Skrein. In business terms, this probably isn't the best idea, since studies show that casting diverse leads in films and movies is more lucrative for studios and producers. The idea that Asians can endure everything they've been through and still be wildly successful means racial discrimination in this country doesn't exist, a notion that harms everyone. By framing Asians as the ideal community of color, the implication is that other communities of color are inherently less than. It erases Asian stories and the issues harming our communities.
You are listening to Let's Talk About Race, the Rising Violence Against Asian Americans in the AAPI Community.
Nia Gray, I know you have to leave early, but you're our faith reporter. How does religion play into this issue, especially the way that the perpetrator, whom we not are going to name, not going to say his name, was given all this sympathy and empathy because of religion?
Well, thank you, Ms. Duke. That is a great question. There's one thing I did want to comment before that on the model minority. And this is something that I've discussed with Asian Americans at my job, Chinese, Japanese, and Korean, is sort of just the double-edged sword of aligning yourself with sort of the white values of the country, identifying that, you know, education, hard work, like these are ways that we can have some upward mobility as immigrants come, that they need to sort of adopt those in various different ways, maybe wanting to not attract attention to themselves. One of my pastors adopted an Asian stepdaughter, and now she's a 16-year-old. And her mom wanted her to come to our Bible study to maybe discuss some of this distress and things that she shared with her mother. And she didn't want to. It could be just teenagers don't want to attract attention to themselves, but it also could be is that she just really wants to fit in. She doesn't want to be seen any different than any other Pittsburgh suburban teenager. But the reality is she is. And there could be sort of the negative stereotypes are attached to that, or even some of the unearned positive stereotypes that are attached to that. So it really is a double-edged sword that you accept one part of this white supremacist system, and then it could also sort of bite you in the butt. So about the shooter and a very complex sort of mixture of a newly born again young person with, and I'm just going by some of the things I read, with the possible sexual addiction. You know, it's interesting because I heard someone on TV say, you can't mask or hide white supremacy with Christianity. And it's true. When you have someone that is a church member, you know, the church always comes out and says, so-and-so was a member. They were great. We never thought this was going to happen. And of course, you didn't know that was going to happen, but I think they fall short when they don't come out with a statement to reiterate what the gospel says and what our beliefs are. We obviously were all open to forgiveness if we repent for our sins, but I think it's important to stand firm on the theology. If the Southern Baptists are preaching this very old school, I call it desperate, sort of messages of fire and brimstone, you're going to go to hell. He feels very convicted and afraid. He's going to go to hell because he's got this sexual addiction. Well, the Bible doesn't say, go destroy your addiction. Go destroy your chains and your bondage by getting rid of it. What we're taught is to use our faith and to use our faith in Christ to help us work through these things. It's not, grace isn't something that we earn on our own, that it's a gift. So I'm really not surprised that somebody would want to sort of quote unquote eliminate their sins on their own. You know, that's sort of where we are. And I'm not really surprised that churches are going back to that fire and brimstone, because I believe it's a way to kind of control people and give them a very limited view of our faith, not teaching the grace, not teaching the love, not teaching the acceptance and reconciliation that they can find. And it's really unfortunate, and I don't like the message that it sends to believers and non-believers, and I don't like it when the Christians double down sort of on those messages. What we really need to do, and we're talking about this at the church right now, is to have a Zoom call so people can openly discuss the Asian bias and the violence that's happening, to go to the scripture to find out exactly how we should be responding to these issues as a community of faith, and then also sort of what we're gonna talk about as well, you know, how to intervene, how to, like Professor Johnson says, is how to intercede for someone. You know, we can do that and we should be doing it. One way we can take action to help the AAPI community is to learn ways to intervene effectively as a bystander without compromising safety. Here are some Asian harassment intervention examples in various situations. The goal is to help you feel confident that you can do something when you see disrespectful behavior or harassment.
Yo, yo bro, what are you doing? Stop hassling that woman. What? What do you mean she's Asian and don't belong here? You know that's a mess of attitude. Miss, are you okay? Let me walk you to your car.
A woman was thrown to the ground, stomped on, while bystanders just watch and do nothing. So what should someone do if they witness such an attack? New York Congressman Grace Ming speaking on that this week on Pix 11.
I know that a lot of people have actually been reaching out, inquiring about bystander intervention type training. I know that there are resources by organizations like PALAVAC and Asian American Federation. What could one even say verbally to help to try to mitigate what what's going on right in front of you. So I know that there's a lot of interest, and we're trying to get the word out more on programs like that as well.
All right, so with that interest in mind, we reached out to the Center for Anti-Violence Education to learn more about intervention training. So joining us now are Reg Ju and Donay Edmond. So good morning to both of you. Thank you for being here. So let's get right into it. And Danae, I'll begin with you. I want to ask what your reaction is to that latest video that we saw this week. It really went viral, gripped so many people, of this woman attacked outside of an apartment building where no one is seen really doing anything to intervene here.
Yeah, I mean, my first reaction is I don't want to keep watching the video, right? I think that so often, just given the last year, what was happening with Black Lives Matter movements and just seeing these acts of violence again and again, I feel for the Asian community, and I feel devastated and sad, and also upset that this history is repeating itself, right? Because of the rhetoric of the last administration, because of the long history of xenophobia and scapegoating, such as the Chinese Exclusion Act, mm-hmm. and because many communities have been scapegoated, specifically Chinese and Asian American communities, we see that instead of the government having an adequate response to public health, we have increased violence, right, because of all this rhetoric. And because there's been a history, just thinking about how many of the victims have been women, of gender-based violence and fetishization of the Asian women, right? And so I see the lack of protection causing it. So I'm devastated. I'm also like, what are the cultural shifts that we need right now? The policy shifts, the shifts in attention, in education, that we can take to end this.
Right, and a lot of people who saw that footage obviously watched it and felt a sense of helplessness, right? Because we couldn't do anything. We saw people who were standing there that weren't doing anything either. So Reg, this question is for you. How does your organization really equip people to help handle these events?
Yeah, that's a really common question we get. And I just want to also contextualize that, you know, violence happens on a gamut, right? What we saw and what we are seeing in the news media are really vicious violence, but majority of these things, incidents, anti-Asian incidents, are verbal harassment. So we want to think about equipping ourselves with an array of tools. And so, you know, we do this in our training online. And one of the ways I would say specifically that it's critical, even if you are a witness or a target, is situational awareness, right? A lot of these things happen. There were a lot of cues, right? And this is not to say we want to blame the victim for not noticing these cues, but there are a lot of things that we can be aware of. Are we looking at our phone when we're walking down the street? Are there other ways, right? When you're talking to someone, they're escalated. Are you thinking about what the nearest exit is? Are you thinking about your tone? Are you thinking about their body gesture, right? What are some of the indicators? So there's many ways that we can assess the environment and even use everyday objects as weapons, because most of us don't carry around knives, right?
Right.
So in our workshop, we go in detail about all of those situational awareness tips, as well as ways to de-escalate.
You are listening to Let's Talk About Race, the Rising Violence Against Asian Americans in the AAPI Community.
Thank you, Nia. Cecil, you're also part of the faith community.
Yes, I'm part of the faith community, and I think it's very important for those of us who affirm that identity to acknowledge some things that are very clear and very simple. It is perhaps not an anomaly that people are acting this way. The largest Christian denomination in the United States is the Southern Baptist Convention. It was born in the principles of white supremacy. It continues to act out that. It continues to have a skewed image of women. It continues to have an incomplete understanding of human sexuality. And we cannot separate Christianity from white supremacy. I think it is incumbent upon us within the faith community, rather than trying to say, well, we are not like that, perhaps ask, well, maybe we are. Maybe we are. And perhaps we have to respond affirmatively to that Shakespearean cry, the fault lies not in the stars, but in ourselves. perhaps there is, and I would say there is, something wrong with our faith, and certainly at a minimum with the way we have proclaimed this faith in this country since 1619, that makes it so repellent and dangerous and violent, and the ground in which white supremacy, male chauvinism, and anti-poor people philosophy resides and grow.
Robert P. Jones is the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute and also author of the new book, White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. Robert, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I'm great. I'm really glad to be here.
So let's just to get us into this topic, can you talk a little bit about, I mean, how far back does the interplay or overlap between white supremacy and American Christianity go, and is it specific to certain denominations?
That's a great opener. Well, it goes all the way back, is the thing there is to say. I mean, all the way back to the founding of the Republic, and in fact, you know, what the version of kind of particularly white Protestant Christianity that lands on American shores, brings with it this entanglement with white supremacy, really from its European roots. So things like Manifest Destiny, the idea that white Europeans are entitled to Native American lands, all the way from the very beginning, I mean, these are very much wrapped up with this entanglement of the idea that kind of white people are meant to be over others in kind of a racial hierarchy, and that this was legitimated by Christian belief, and it kind of brought and kind of came over legitimated and packaged in a kind of white Christian theological package.
When we look at the Northern Baptist, Southern Baptist split, which is something that has been written about from a number of different angles over the years, how much was that split related to this issue of white supremacy?
Yeah, well, it was the reason, really, that Baptists in the North and Baptists in the South parted ways. It was literally over whether a ordained member of the clergy could enslave other human beings on the basis of the color of their skin and still, retain their status as a clergy person, and that whether this was a legitimately Christian thing to do. And Baptists in the North rejected that view. Baptists in the South were so dedicated to protecting, not only this possibility, but this as a Christian norm, that they literally split from their Northern brethren, set up their own, convention called the Southern Baptist Convention. That's where that name comes from, in 1845. So this is well before even the Civil War. This is my home denomination, I should say, that I grew up in as a Southern Baptist in Mississippi. That history, I think, is one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is that history is not well known, really. I mean, even I, growing up inside the church, didn't find out about it until I was in seminary, so in my early 20s. But the one thing to say to answer the first part of your question, is that while I think this history is most kind of on the surface with a organization like the Southern Baptist Convention, virtually every Protestant denomination split over the issue of slavery and white supremacy in the Civil War. The Methodist split, Presbyterian split, the Episcopalians split, and it was all really over this question of the legitimacy of slavery, and then underneath that, the kind of bigger thing that that justifies that, this idea of white supremacy.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet. One way we can take action to help the AAPI community is to learn ways to intervene effectively as a bystander without compromising safety. Here are some Asian harassment intervention examples in various situations. The goal is to help you feel confident that you can do something when you see disrespectful behavior or harassment.
Good morning, Mark.
I wanted to talk to you before class starts. I was curious about your sweatshirt. This is the first time I've seen you wear it to class. Is it new?
Yeah, it is. I ordered it online and just got it in the mail yesterday.
What is the message you think this sweatshirt conveys?
I think it's just a really cool shirt. I'm letting people know that the Chinese caused all this trouble with the coronavirus. I see people at school wearing Black Lives Matter shirts. Why do they get to do that?
I think your message and Black Lives Matter is not the same. Black Lives Matter is about social justice. The statement, Chinese virus, is about assigning blame. I think it is important to remember that our school has many Asian and Pacific Islander students. Some are in our class. This type of rhetoric has stirred antagonism against Asian Americans and caused verbal and physical assaults. This message is just not consistent with our school values.
Well, I think the Chinese need to be held responsible.
The World Health Care Organization and the International Courts of Justice, they are working on the many questions this pandemic has raised. However, many U.S. citizens have coronavirus, and they did not get it in China. They got it here. So in some sense, we all have a responsibility. I think we just need to do whatever it takes, wear a mask, social distance, and our other safety practices to stop the spread and end this virus. Before today, Mark, I would ask you if you would reconsider wearing that sweatshirt. Could you turn it inside out or wear a jacket?
You know what? I have a hoodie in the car. Do you mind if I go get it?
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet. You are listening to Let's Talk About Race, the rising violence against Asian Americans in the AAPI community.
My only note was just to support what you said, Lanita, that sex addiction isn't a real thing. There was a recent study from UCLA that looked into this and found that people who had self-proclaimed had a sex addiction actually just had normally high libido, but moral judgments about what was the meaning of those sexual impulses. Also, sex addiction or hypersexuality was rejected in the latest edition of the DSM-5, which is like the handbook of psychiatric disorders. Thinking about when is sex addiction claimed, I think is very telling, as you noted. When you're rich, like you're Harvey Weinstein, you get to say you have a sex addiction. When you're a white man perpetrating a hate crime, you get to say that you had a sex addiction, and that might be a real scapegoat for you.
There is no such thing as sex addiction, and counselors who call themselves sex addiction therapists are poorly trained. They have little to no data to support their approach, and it's also poorly defined. That's why the DSM, the statistical manual that therapists use to diagnose problems, chose not to include sex addiction or hypersexuality in the new version, the new edition of the DSM. They didn't even include it in an appendix to study it further because they didn't take it seriously. I think they were right. The sex addiction, you have to be kind of addicted to something external to the body, like alcohol or a drug, and sex is part of us, so that doesn't qualify. So using a disease model for sex is not a useful concept, and what it does is reinforce guilt and shame about sex instead of taking a sex-positive approach. So what I'm saying is that sex addiction itself is a myth. But this doesn't mean that some people don't have problems being out of balance, like becoming too obsessed with sex, like on the internet or whatever, pornography. And those people come to my office and I help them get into balance by doing basic cognitive behavioral therapy and helping them realize that sex is a good thing, but you have to put it in a context along with other things too. So instead of instilling guilt and shame about sex, I try to provide a sense of balance so that a person accepts themselves for who they are, but that they get beyond being compulsive and obsessive about sex.
I just wanted to throw that in there.
I had one follow-up thought because there has been this controversy about whether or not this is a hate crime. And I think it speaks to what you raised about being victimized twice, first by the violence and then by the attempt to dismiss this or to represent this as anything other than a hate crime. And it has been surprising to me the number of people that have tried to make this argument, in spite of the fact that the shooter actually bypassed non-Asian spas and to go specifically to them. I just don't see, given the facts, how you can argue that this is not targeting Asians and that it wasn't a hate crime. And really, what this person has done, which he seemed to have gained some public sympathy around his faith and this quote-unquote addiction, which I think Althea spoke to and you spoke to very well, just the notion that he might be treated more sympathetically. The logic there, really hard to follow.
You are listening to Let's Talk About Race, the Rising Violence Against Asian Americans in the AAPI Community.
I want to circle back around to Nia. Let's talk about the African American community's relationship with Asian Americans. It has been filled with contradictions and strife and violence. And I want to be brutally honest here by saying some of the perpetrators are African American males.
I think it's clear to all of us that the sickness of white supremacy is so powerful that it impacts all peoples and all cultures in the American society. I think there is a reality, a recognition that there have been tensions and troubling relationships between African Americans and Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, and communities throughout the United States. We can name them easily, but I think it's related to a larger problem in terms of the way our society is structured, the way our economy is laid out. And so it's a larger argument in terms of we have to rethink, reimagine, recreate our larger society. However, that does not exempt the responsibility of individual community to stand up and say that this is behavior that should not be tolerated. And I think it is important when we see that type of hatred and violence perpetrated by those in the African American community, it is incumbent upon other African Americans to stand up, to name it, to denounce it, and say why it is, to offer a different analysis of framing why things are so bad in our communities today. It is not because of that individual shop that's owned by a member of a different community that you are oppressed. Within the larger economy and society, there are more powerful things that have created very difficult for African American communities to thrive. So it is important to denounce it, but also to realize why these things happen, and also to not to stop there by denouncing it, but also by widening our discussion by saying, why do we live in a society where we pit one oppressed minority against another oppressed minority? Who benefits?
One way we can take action to help the AAPI community is to learn ways to intervene effectively as a bystander without compromising safety. Here are some Asian harassment intervention examples in various situations. The goal is to help you feel confident that you can do something when you see disrespectful behavior or harassment. Excuse me, what did you just say to Mr. Chi? That was very rude. I've shopped here for beauty and hair products for 5 years, and the Chi family has been nothing but nice. I've noticed that Mr. Chi will put the change down and not in your hand, and that's a cultural difference and not to be taken as offense. While I noticed your negative attitude since you walked in here, and it's not necessary, and he doesn't deserve it directed at him. Girl, I will always keep it 100, and you're wrong. There are 3 hair stores on this block, but I think Mr. Chi is the best, and that's why I shop here. If you don't like it, take your business elsewhere.
What can we do as individuals and as a community to show up for our Asian Pacific Islanders communities, especially as we move forward in society? There's another mass shooting. There'll be another mass shooting. There'll be another crisis. How can we not forget what we're learning from this tragedy?
It's definitely a moment to learn, to relearn, and to engage with others who are new to that type of thing. So it's an opportunity to get connected with and support advocacy organizations in your community, because even though tragedies bring new people to the issue, there's always folks who have been working on it before. In this instance, and broadly, hypersexualization of Asian women is certainly a pernicious phenomenon. And as Professor Johnson mentioned, 1875, the Page Act prevented Chinese women from immigrating to the U.S. unless they could prove that they weren't prostitutes. And so there's this, it's all tied up in this history, and with World War II and the Korean War, the way that American soldiers were coming into contact with Asian women was either as of them being like servants in a nearby town or in sex work. And then you have war brides being brought home after the Korean War. And so there's like a particular stew of xenophobia and hypersexualization and misogyny that's all steeped together in the way that Asian women are treated. There was a 2013 study that found that Asian women were the most desirable racial group among white men and among other races, specifically for this specific idea that they're both hypersexual but also submissive and docile, and you can do whatever you want. It's not in their, you know, whatever conception of nature you have to contradict a man. And that ends up being really dangerous, because if there are only 2 accepted stereotypical extremes that an Asian woman can exist in, it leaves very little room for individual self-expression and can lead to what we saw in Atlanta.
Cecil, I'd like a man's point of view on that question.
Well, I think it comes down to dismantling this patriarchal white supremacist society. Certainly women, and particularly in this discussion, I believe the word you used, the eroticization of Asian women, is a product of our society. And I think until we get a grasp and a real commitment to examine our patriarchy and to begin to dismantle it, we will continue to fail to make the type of changes and to promote the type of world where people of all genders are able to stand in their truth and to be accepted for who they are. We are not dependent or should be subservient to one another, gender or race or culture. So it's a lot of work we need to do, and we need to do it now.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by Grassroots News.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.